Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. Today's editorial page in the Capital Gazette says, "Today we are speechless. Yesterday, a gunman killed five people in the Capital Gazette newsroom in Annapolis, Maryland. Their names were also on the editorial page. The rest is blank." Gerald Fishman was an editorial writer. Rob Hyacin was an assistant editor and columnist. John McNamara was a writer. Rebecca Smith was a sales assistant. And Wendy Winters was the special publications editor. A number of reporters and staffers were tweeting once the gunman entered the building yesterday, and at the end of the day, they said, "Tomorrow we will put out a paper." Well, we invited today's guest, Alfredo Corchado, to join us to talk about what is happening in Mexico. Mexicans are going to the polls on Sunday to choose a new president as violence has escalated. Last year, 30,000 people were killed, including politicians and journalists. But we're going to kick it off by talking with Alfredo about yesterday's horrific killing. Alfredo Corchado is an award-winning correspondent for the Dallas Morning News covering the border. We will also talk about the continuing story about children who've been separated from their parents. Alfredo Corchado's latest book is Homelands, Four Friends, Two Countries, and the Fate of the Great Mexican-American Migration. It's a narrative that mixes the personal and the political to tell the story of Mexican-American life in the past half century. Hi, Alfredo. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me back. It's been a while.
Yes, it's great to have you back. And later in the show, we are going to talk about all of the news coming out of the Supreme Court, decisions affecting labor, gerrymandering, women's health, and more. We'll also talk about the future of the court with Justice Anthony Kennedy. And I would like to welcome Mark Joseph Stern, who is a reporter with Slate, where he covers courts and the law. And one of Mark's recent pieces really says it all. The end of Roe, Anthony Kennedy's retirement, ensures the Supreme Court will allow states to outlaw abortion. It's almost difficult to read that sentence. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you so much. Well, I want to start off by talking with both of you about the horrific shooting yesterday. I just want to read from Democracy Now! Just to let people know what happened, because they put together a really good summarization. In Annapolis, Maryland, a gunman armed with a shotgun and smoke grenade stormed the newsroom of the Capital Gazette newspaper. The dead were identified as editors, reporters, and staff. They identified the gunman as Jared Ramos, a 38-year-old white man from Laurel, Maryland, with a history of posting violent threats on social media. In 2013, he unsuccessfully sued the paper for defamation after it reported on his online verbal abuse of a female former classmate. Ramos pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor harassment charge. A Twitter account bearing his name made an explicit threat against two employees in 2015, saying, quote, "It would be nicer to see them cease breathing." So just a little bit of background there. Alfredo Corchado, what was your reaction when you heard about this, and what did you think of all of the tweets that we got in real time from the reporters?
Well, it was terrifying. It was a sad, sad day. I was still in El Paso, Texas, when this happened, and my immediate thought was, I turned my attention to Mexico because I'm so used to these incidents happening in Mexico, you know, a gunman coming in Nuevo Laredo newsroom, or in Torreon, Coahuila, et cetera. So it took a little bit to let it sink in that this was actually happening in the United States, in Annapolis. But it says also a lot about the resiliency of our colleagues, of journalists. You know, we will put out a paper and we will report on what happened. Unfortunately, you know, it happened way too much in Mexico already this year. And, you know, yesterday was the bloodiest day for American journalists. Five people killed. This year we've had six journalists killed throughout the country. So it kind of tells you the magnitude of what happened yesterday.
Well, and we'll talk about your personal stories, but you have also received threats because of the reporting that you've done from Mexico.
Right. I received several threats in my coverage of the paramilitary group in Nuevo Laredo. I've had to leave the country at times. But again, you know, I've always felt more protected in Mexico as an American journalist. So for this to happen on the U.S. side, it's really, really a sad day for all journalism.
Mm. Mark, you have also received death threats. You tweeted yesterday that the shooting is every journalist's worst nightmare. Like many of my colleagues, I have received death threats and have no illusion that this could never happen to me.
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, it's a very common issue for journalists today that we all receive from time to time violent messages and sometimes even graphic and explicit death threats. And those certainly peaked for me around the election, but they have continued since then. I have no real way of gauging whether they're serious. I think it's actually less bad for me than it is for a lot of women journalists. I believe, anecdotally at least, this issue is even worse for lots of women who also frequently receive rape threats and violent sexual threats. Mm. But this is just the world we're living in today. It's extremely easy for someone sitting behind a keyboard to send out an anonymous tweet or email that graphically threatens your life. And as a journalist, there's not that much we can do about it. If we live in the United States, anyone can easily get a gun. And so if someone decides to shoot one of us because of something we've written, there's just not that much we can do except for hope that it never happens.
And yesterday, a lot of people, before we had all of the facts, a lot of people were talking about Donald Trump's consistent attacks against journalists. It is very common at his rallies. In fact, this just happened, where the journalists are in the background and he tells the crowd to turn around and they all start yelling at these journalists. And then later in the day, we did find out that this shooter does have a history with the Capital Gazette. But what about that, Alfredo? I mean, journalists are under attack in ways that we haven't seen in our lifetimes.
Exactly. I mean, that's the other chilling thing, is that we, you know, and we become sort of the enemy of the people and so forth. At least that's how the president refers to us. So the mood in the country, the mood against journalists, against, you know, people seeking truth, doesn't help the situation. And it's not surprising that many newspapers last night decided to put extra security at the entrance, because there is that fear of copycat. There is that fear that, you know, if the president is the number one anti-journalist person, then there might be others who follow it. And, you know, it's setting a bad, bad precedent. I'm glad that the president today condemned the killing and stood up for journalists. I mean, I hope that changes the tone. I'm not so sure about that, but at least it was a good sign.
What do you think, Mark?
Well, we now know that, of course, we cannot lay this shooting at the president's feet. That would be wildly irresponsible. This man is disturbed and violent and, as you said, has a history with the newspaper. But at the same time, I think it's absolutely reasonable and, in fact, vital to note that Trump has gone out of his way to create an atmosphere in which journalists are not guardians of the free press, but rather enemies of the people. These are words that he himself uses, that his allies use, to frame us as the opposition. And it is no surprise that some of his allies then take that a bit further and deploy this kind of violent or suggestively violent rhetoric on social media that whips people up into a frenzy. I have not personally attended any Trump rallies, but I know a number of journalists have. And when they reveal who they are, that they're covering the story for a paper, they are immediately assaulted with threats and horrible language and, you know, just the worst kind of verbal attack you could imagine. That is an unhealthy state for the press to be in the United States today or anywhere at any time. I think it brings attention to a boiling point and it frames us as enemies of the people, even enemies of the truth, when in reality all we're trying to do is report on the truth and hold powerful people accountable.
Right, and we would like to spend all of our time doing that, but the fact of the matter is you have people like conservative provocateur Milo I always get his last name wrong, Yiannopoulos. And yesterday he insisted that he was not being serious when he recently told two reporters that he, quote, can't wait for vigilante squads to start gunning journalists.
Yes.
Mark, what about that? I mean, we have to talk about this. Mark?
Well, I think it's a disgusting and horrifying quote. I think the more attention we give people like Milo, unfortunately, the more popular they remain, the more attention they get from the masses. And so I don't want to turn this into a story about him, but obviously that quote is inciting violence against journalists. That is the only way that it can really be read. I don't know if it would meet the definition of incitement in a court of law, but certainly any layperson reading that would think, yeah, it's time to go out and shoot journalists. The fact that someone did that yesterday makes the quote even more chilling and, in a way, disturbingly prescient.
And talking about journalists who are killed in Mexico, Alfredo, unfortunately, this is happening on a regular basis. Can you give us some context here? Is it getting worse, and why?
Well, Mexico remains one of the most dangerous places to practice journalism, especially throughout Latin America. And unfortunately, it's gotten worse. I mean, last year, more than 30,000 people were killed, which set a historic level in the country. This is a country that, since 2006, 2007, you've seen more than 200,000 victims of drug violence. And to see that last year being a historic record, this year alone, we're already 20% up higher from a year ago. So you can kind of imagine why a left-leaning candidate like Andrés Manuel López Obrador is favored to win the election this weekend. I mean, people are really, I mean, just fed up. I mean, they've had the ruling party for nearly 80 years run this country. They've had the opposition, conservative National Action Party, tried out for 12 years. Nothing has changed for many, whether it's security, whether it's wages. I mean, here we are 25 years after NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement, and wages are either the same or even lower than they were back in 1994.
Wow.
So I think there is a real sense of we have to change the narrative. We have to change the destiny for Mexico. Whether that happens or not, I mean, we'll see. But as of now, I mean, López Obrador, again, is really the heavy favorite to win the election this weekend, this Sunday.
And tell us more about him. He is a member of the National Regeneration Party, also known as Morena.
Right. He was a longtime member of the for a while, I think, if you were in politics, you had to be a member of the ruling party. Then he was head of the PRD, the Party of the Democratic Revolution. They had some heated disagreements, and López Obrador basically created his own movement known as Morena, it's named after the brown-skinned Virgin of Guadalupe, the view throughout Latin America. So he has his own party. He's a native of Tabasco, a southern state of Tabasco, former mayor of Mexico City, author, and he's got many interesting things. I mean, whether or not he can carry them out, I mean, if you talk to voters and analysts, they question whether he really has a plan. But it's interesting that he wants to cut his own salary by half. He says he won't live in the presidential palace and instead live in a small, modest apartment. He will drive his own car or have someone drive his own, Nissan, white Nissan they still use it. So I think those kinds of ideals appeal to many voters who are really tired of the corruption that we've seen throughout the years of the president, the current president, Enrique Peña Nieto. But what's be interesting to watch is whether he can not just win the presidency, but also win a majority in Congress, and then I think you will have possible changes, and especially on economic energy reforms, etc. He promised to look at contracts that were signed with big U.S. corporations who want to do energy in Mexico. So there's a lot of things to watch in the next few months.
And Alfredo, how often do you go to Mexico to report? And what is it like for you in terms of safety, given that so many journalists have been killed?
I'm the what they call the Mexico border correspondent. So I report out of the border, thanks in large part because of President Trump has made the border such a hot topic these days. I mean, it's the place to be. But I still have my apartment in Mexico City. I still report out of Mexico City and throughout the country. I mean, it's I was born in Mexico. I came as a six-year-old. So it's important that as a Mexican reporter like myself, that I do have some kind of protection as a U.S. citizen. Hmm. And I think that's helped a lot over the years as I traveled throughout the country. It used to be reporting this kind of story. It used to be that there was really the border areas that were the most dangerous places to report. But again, last year, this year, it's really throughout the country. So you have to be careful when you travel, how you travel. I do very little traveling at night. I mean, you always have to do a lot of pre-reporting before you go to a certain region or a certain area because of the pull of the cartels. I mean, back when I was reporting this, we had something like 5 or 6 major cartels to report on. These days, you're looking at something like more than 400 small criminal groups. Mm-hmm. Throughout the country. I mean, there's still some very big, dominant ones, but it kind of gives you a sense of the insecurity situation in the country when you have more than 400 criminal groups operating. And when journalists, you know, get in the way, unfortunately, you become a victim.
What is Obrador saying about the drug war and all of the violence that has happened as a result of the drug war?
Well, he says a lot of things. Again, it's hard to get him on specifics, but he says, for example, that he wants to offer amnesty to small-time criminals as a way of sort of the country coming together, making peace with the past, its bloody past. It's an idea that doesn't fit well with all Mexicans, obviously. I mean, there's too many victims who are still clamoring for justice. In Mexico, more than 95-98% of all crimes are never solved. So people mm-hmm. want some kind of justice. And yet there's also people who say, well, you know, I think we have to move on. We have to kind of get beyond this and realize that much of the violence happening in Mexico is because of U.S. demand for drugs. So by offering amnesty to small-time criminals, like maybe, you know, distributors, et cetera, it's a sign that we have to come together as a nation. He's also said that he will dismantle intelligence agencies, which is an idea that doesn't really sit well with a lot of people, particularly the U.S. government. I mean, how do you have U.S.-Mexico cooperation if you don't have intelligence agencies? So, you wonder whether a lot of this is part of this populist message. You know, he's going to go after the mafia group, the mafia in power, as he calls it, and the corruption by setting the example as president and saying, I'm an honest guy. I believe that in honesty in the Mexican people. I don't know that that's the message that will actually transform Mexico. But again, when you go to his speeches, I mean, he doesn't give that many interviews. I mean, he's given a very few. But when you listen to his speeches, listen to the interviews, he's very, very short on specifics. At this point, we just don't know. We're hoping that if he does win, as predicted by many polls, that he will actually sit down for more interviews. The new president will take office December 1st. So between July 1st and December 1st, we hope to get a lot more details and a lot more specifics, not just for readers. In the United States, but I think for readers in Mexico who are still sort of saying, you know, we want change, very much like the United States wanted change in 2016. But, you know, are we going to get the same result? I mean, López Obrador by no means is a Donald Trump, a President Trump. He's been the mayor before. He's been in politics much of his life. When he was mayor, he was known to be much more moderate, much more pragmatic. So I think there's a sense that, you know, there's a populist rhetoric and maybe there's a realistic rhetoric. Well, that's the way to see it.
Alfredo Corchado is an award-winning correspondent for the Dallas Morning News. His latest book is Homelands, Four Friends, Two Countries, and the Fate of the Great Mexican-American Migration. Mark Joseph Stern is a reporter for Slate, where he covers courts and the law. Later in the show, we'll be talking about coverage of the Supreme Court and Justice Anthony Kennedy's decision to retire. You can join us at 866-798-8255. If you have any questions or comments about coverage of Mexico, the violence there, we're going to talk about the ongoing story about children who've been separated from their parents. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Mark, last week we talked about all of the excellent reporting that is happening about children who've been separated from their parents. And yesterday, this didn't get as much attention because of the horrific shooting in Annapolis, but 575 women were arrested in Washington inside of the Senate building. They wrapped themselves in those foil blankets, shouting things like, "We care," demanding that kids are reunited with their families. So that really stood out. And then yesterday on Terry Gross Fresh Air, she spoke with New Yorker writer Jonathan Blitzer. He's been in El Paso reporting, and it was a heart-wrenching interview. He said, quote, "I've been meeting women who are crying so violently they can barely speak." He said what these moms are going through is nothing short of torture. What really stands out for you in the reporting on this tragedy?
Well, the reporting has been a triumph in the face of tragedy, I think, and it makes you understand why Trump loathes the press so much, because if the press had not highlighted this story and actually gone to the border and gone to these facilities where children are being held away from their parents, we might not know very much about it. And in fact, it might still be going on. It was popular pressure that compelled Trump to sign an order purporting to end the practice, although it doesn't fully end it, and in fact the government does not have a clear plan to reunite the children who were separated from their families. But I think this was, in many ways, a victory of fact-based reporting combined with the emotional gut punch of the photojournalism we saw of these children and their parents, of this incredibly it seemed like an alien scene, something from World War II, something from another time or place, the U.S. government doing violence to families, committing these barbaric acts against these families for simply seeking asylum, an action that is protected under both the U.S. Constitution and a number of international treaties to which the United States is a party. Watching the U.S. government completely flout its obligations under international law, flout these families' fundamental due process rights, and separate them in this most traumatic way. Watching it happen, seeing the photos, and reading about the distressing details, it awoke the country's conscience in a way that I don't think we've seen since perhaps the first travel ban that Trump signed shortly after he took office, when individuals were detained in airports, deported back to their home countries, and citizens flooded the airports to protest and provide legal aid. This, I think, was another defining moment in the resistance to Donald Trump and his policies, and it was all facilitated by the really courageous work of the press.
And Alfredo,
I salute the press. I mean, they did tremendous work. That was in Pernillo, Texas, and El Paso. And, you know, whether you agree or disagree with Trump's policies, it really came down to journalists very simply, very basically, putting a human face on the issue and letting people, you know, figure things out. I mean, humanity, humanizing the issue with facts, I think, you know, went a long, long way in changing. And not really changing. I mean, I was just at a press conference on Wednesday where, in El Paso, where some of the immigrant rights activists were saying, you know, the government is talking about all these reunifications, more than 500. It really hasn't happened. I mean, they're still talking about, at least as a Wednesday night, less than 10 families reunited. I mean, it's still very, very much a tragic, tragic story. Where are the children? Where are the parents? There's still too many questions that we don't have answers to.
Well, Alfredo, thank you for joining us. Thanks for your reporting, and we would love to have you back to spend the hour on your new book.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Alfredo Corchado is an award-winning correspondent for the Dallas Morning News, where he covers the border. His latest book is Homelands, Four Friends, Two Countries, and the Fate of the Great Mexican-American Migration. After the break, we will talk about coverage of the Supreme Court and Justice Anthony Kennedy's decision to retire with Mark Joseph Stern, a reporter for Slate, and we'll also be joined by Bob Agelko, a reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. There are many ways you can take part in today's conversation. On the phone, by sending an email to yourcall@klw.org, or by going to the yourcallradio.org website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by phone, call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Coming up at 11, a further roundup of the week's news with 1A from WAMU in Washington. Stay with us.
This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about media coverage of the very important and long-lasting Supreme Court decisions that have come down over the last couple weeks. We also just got word that Justice Anthony Kennedy is retiring. He is a conservative, but he was the swing vote on so many crucial social issues, including gay marriage and abortion. We're joined by Mark Joseph Stern, a reporter for Slate, where he covers the courts and the law. And now I would like to welcome Bob Agelko to the show. Bob is a reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle, where he covers state and federal courts in California, the Supreme Court, and the state bar. And he has been covering these cases and the decision by Justice Kennedy. Hi, Bob. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Great to have you. Bob, I have to start off by asking you about the future of Roe, because legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin was on CNN a couple days ago. He said within 18 months, abortion will be illegal in 20 states. And then Mark, our other guest, has a piece called The End of Roe. Do you agree, Bob?
Well, if you had to take a bet, it would seem more likely than not. Obviously, it all depends on the new nominee and where a couple of key Republicans stand, who say that they are pro-choice or pro-abortion rights, namely Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins. Will either of them hold out against a candidate who, as President Trump has said all of his candidates are, is committed to overturning Roe versus Wade, the 1973 ruling that legalized abortion nationwide. Now, as you point out, it wouldn't have any a direct impact on California. We have our own Roe versus Wade law, but there are a number of states that have laws in place that would outlaw abortion if Roe were repealed. And Justice Kennedy was the fifth vote in 1992 to preserve the core of Roe and say that states could not place an undue burden on abortion, whatever that means. It's kind of varied over the years. With his departure, there seems like a fair prospect, one, that an anti-abortion justice will be confirmed. And again, it may come down to a couple of Republican senators. And two, that the court will soon confront a case that asks them to repeal. Now, Chief Justice Roberts, who is said to be the new swing vote, also has some commitment to the court as an institution, to upholding precedent. He, after all, was the fifth vote to sustain most of the Affordable Care Act a few years ago. Justice Kennedy voted to overturn all of it. So it could be that Chief Justice Roberts would hold out for not doing a clean sweep of Roe. But Mark Stern and other prognosticators say there won't be much or anything left of Roe versus Wade in 18 months. And if I had to bet, I wouldn't bet the other way.
Well, Mark, you lay it out in your piece. You say that what might happen is a state will create some extreme obstacle to abortion access, like Arkansas's effort to ban medical abortions. Advocates will then sue, alleging the law is unconstitutional. The Supreme Court will take the case, and then it will hold by a 5-4 vote.
Yes, and I think it's important to note that the court doesn't have to come out and say, we are overturning Roe. It doesn't have to acknowledge what it's doing outright. What it can do instead is define down that concept of an undue burden to the point that it is absolutely meaningless. And that is the incrementalist strategy that anti-abortion advocates have mounted over the last few years, and they've been partly successful. I think that there is an overwhelming likelihood that Chief Justice Roberts views the continued existence of Roe as a greater threat to the institution of the court than would be overturning Roe, or at least reducing it to the point of meaninglessness. And so I think if any Republican senators are serious about supporting Roe as precedent or supporting the right to choice, they would have to interrogate Trump's pick and potentially vote against him or her, because we know that Trump's entire legal team has been waiting for the moment to appoint a justice to overturn Roe. This is that moment, and the choice will be in the Senate's hands.
And as you report, Mark, Roberts, Alito, and Gorsuch were selected because a group of very smart lawyers felt totally confident that they would overturn Roe and Casey.
Yes, and, you know, just on Wednesday, the court overturned a 41-year precedent that enabled unions to collect certain fees from non-members. That affected 22 states, thousands and thousands of contracts, and millions of employees across the country. It will cause chaos and confusion for years to come and kneecap unions' political strength. And yet the court's five conservative justices, including Kennedy, didn't even blink before issuing that ruling. So I don't think that this is a conservative majority that's hugely concerned about the court's institutional legitimacy or prestige when it gets a case that allows it to enshrine some deeply felt conservative principle into law.
We're going to get to Janice in just a minute, but I have one more question about abortion, because I've been hearing hosts very casually ask, will Roe be overturned? Bob, the consequences of this are really shocking when you look at the fact that, according to the Guttmacher Institute, there are 25 million unsafe abortions every year around the globe. 70,000 women die. And those are only the deaths that we know of. So what about that? I mean, what is a reporter's responsibility to talk about the consequences of something like this?
Quite substantial, I think, because there's always the tendency to politicize everything. You know, is this going to be, you know, a victory for Trump? Are we going to talk about, you know, pro-life versus pro-choice and things like that? The human consequences of it are, you know, very significant, and we don't have to look very far outside our borders to see countries where abortion is illegal, and the health consequences of that. I mean, and you know, Mark was saying just before that the court could reduce Roe to a shell of itself, and that may well be the more likely immediate prospect. That seemed to be what was on the table in 2016 with the Texas law that basically imposed many stringent medical requirements having nothing to do with abortion, really, on abortion clinics, and would have closed most of them. Justice Kennedy cast the fifth vote and wrote the opinion that struck down this law as an undue burden. It doesn't take too much imagination to see that no matter who the next appointee is, laws like that will not be considered an undue burden, and the consequences to health are relatively obvious, but it's something that reporters do really need to explore just as much as the politics of all this.
Mark, what about that?
Yes, I certainly agree. I'm working on a piece myself right now about this concept that pro-life advocates have bandied about, that it is possible to criminalize abortion without punishing women who obtain abortions. The key problem with that theory is that we have actually moved on from the era of back alley abortions to a large extent. Before Roe, the only way to get an abortion was surgically, whereas today we have developed and sell on the market chemicals that very easily induce labor and create what is sometimes called a medical abortion, sometimes called an early intended miscarriage, and women will be able to access these drugs. They already have and do in states like Texas, where they are prevalent all along the border. They can be purchased online with ease. No, it is not legal to obtain these, but women are still going to, and that will leave prosecutors with quite a difficult decision. We've been told over and over again that women won't be punished for getting abortions. But what happens when women are the ones performing the abortions on themselves? I think the question of medical self-induced abortions or intentional miscarriages will be a huge one in the post-Roe landscape, and quite frankly, probably a consequence that not many advocates on either side have spent a long time thinking about. Mm.
And before we leave the topic, you know, unless you've already mentioned it, it should be pointed out that Justice Kennedy, for all of his role in preserving, you know, the core of Roe, also wrote the opinion a few years ago that upheld a ban on kind of mid to late term abortions, and said, just by the way, that it's well known, citing no evidence, that many women come to regret their decisions to have an abortion, which I guess showed that he was emotionally conflicted about it. And you know, these are the kinds of statements I think that you know, the justices and courts make in passing that go into building a base for removing a precedent.
What about language here? A caller just said, you know, pro-choice is not pro-abortion. It means you have the choice. We also get a lot of calls saying that pro-life, when you're talking about a Republican Party that is separating children from their families, constantly votes against policies that would help families, should we really be calling these people pro-life? How do you deal with this as reporters?
It's a great question. A stylistic one for us, we struggle because we don't want to infuse our very description of a movement with some kind of ideological or political bent. At the same time, I and many others do feel that both of these labels, pro-choice and pro-life, have really outlived their usefulness, because, you know, there is certainly hypocrisy in a pro-life party that separates children from their parents and attempts to strip them of health care, and also pro-choice is just such a weird, broad term. I don't know of a better shorthand to use, but I prefer simply individuals who would prefer to maintain access to abortion, and individuals who want to criminalize abortion and those who perform it, including, again, the women themselves.
Bob, what do you think?
I'm with that. I try not to use either term. Abortion rights and anti-abortion seem adequate substitutes. Maybe people can suggest better ones, but I'd rather basically tell people what's at stake here, and not allow the two sides to label themselves.
Well, in related news, Bob, this was on the front page of the Bay Area section in the Chronicle. You wrote about the Supreme Court siding with California's anti-abortion pregnancy centers.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us an overview of that one?
Yeah, well, just this week, the court, 5-4, ruled in a case involving these, I guess they're called crisis pregnancy centers. They are several thousand of them nationwide, and more than 200 in California. They tend to be located fairly near abortion clinics, and they outnumber them. They advertise themselves as providing a full range of reproductive services, but basically they are there to, in part at least, to try to talk women out of getting abortions. One of the dire consequences, they give tests, they provide prenatal care, and so forth. Anyway, the state, the legislature, the Democratic majority, said that these were deceptive centers, and passed a law that said that they needed to post state notices to their patients saying that the state makes abortion and reproductive services available at little or no cost to low-income women. They sued and said that this violates their freedom of speech. Lower courts disagreed, said that the notices were accurate and furthered the cause of health care. The Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that it did, in fact, violate free speech. Justice Thomas, for the majority, invoked past attempts by Nazi and Soviet governments to suppress health care in the name of the state. Justice Kennedy wrote a concurring opinion that talked about how this it was a severe burden on freedom of speech. Even though the message is the state's and not these centrists, so that's the law, that the state may not do this. It doesn't rule out the possibility that other laws against deceptive practices could be enforced by the state or the law enforcement, and that's what abortion rights groups are hoping. In the meantime, just in a later development, the court this week also set aside a ruling on cell phone radiation that had required cell phone sellers in the city of Berkeley to post notices saying that carrying cell phones in your pocket or in your bra close to your body could exceed federal radiation standards, which basically mirrors what the Federal Communications Commission has said. Lower court upheld it. The Supreme Court said, in light of what we said about these unwanted messages in the abortion case, you, Ninth Circuit Court in San Francisco, are to reconsider the case. In light of that, we're going to vacate your ruling and check it out and see if this meets the free speech standards that we have now set for you.
Bob Agelko is a reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle, where he covers state and federal courts in California, the Supreme Court, and the State Bar. Mark Joseph Stern is a reporter for Slate, where he covers courts and the law. And today it's our media roundtable. We are talking about coverage of the Supreme Court and Justice Kennedy's decision to retire. Mark, there's so many questions about Justice Kennedy and what he meant for the court and his swing votes on social issues. What are your thoughts about gay marriage? You had another piece called Anthony Kennedy Just Destroyed His Legacy as a Gay Rights Hero.
Right. So this is another area where I think the Supreme Court can incrementally chip away at Kennedy's legacy before doing away with it altogether. And I think the strategy here is quite simple, and the ball is already rolling because states have attempted to cut back on that fundamental right to same-sex marriage enshrined into the Constitution by the Supreme Court in Obergefell versus Hodges by saying, well, yes, we will give same-sex couples marriage licenses, but we're not going to give them all of the benefits that we give to opposite-sex couples. So, for instance, in Texas, the government is attempting to deny equal spousal benefits to same-sex couples under the argument that they don't deserve them because they can't have biological children. And somewhat similarly, Arkansas tried to prevent same-sex couples from having both their names placed on their child's birth certificate. It's very common to have non-biological parents put on a child's birth certificate. For instance, most adoptive parents, even though they're not related to their child biologically, get a new birth certificate with their names on it. The state of Arkansas tried to prevent same-sex couples from doing this simply because they were gay. The U.S. Supreme Court ultimately stepped in and reversed that decision. Now I think we will see more states trying to play this game by cutting back on benefits for same-sex couples with the hope that the Supreme Court will allow them to cut back on these benefits. Eventually, the Supreme Court could then say, well, you know what, we've cut back on Obergefell so much that now it's time to just overrule it outright.
And Mark, you wrote about Justice Neil Gorsuch's close ties with the groups that bankrolled Janus, and it's starting to get more attention. Like in these times, the progressive media did a lot of great reporting around this. But talk about that. What do we need to know about Neil Gorsuch and the close ties with the groups that bankrolled Janus, and what do we need to know about those groups?
Yeah, so first it's important to note that Neil Gorsuch is on the Supreme Court because dark money groups spent about $17 million in total to keep Merrick Garland, Obama's nominee, off of the court, and then to get Gorsuch on the court. We don't know exactly who spent that money, but the paper trail does strongly suggest it was anti-labor advocates, billionaires with a vested interest in preventing labor, specifically organized labor, from gaining political strength. We also know that Gorsuch is a very, very close associate with the Fund for American Studies, which is an anti-labor group that is bankrolled by some of the same foundations, Koch brothers type billionaire foundations, that bankrolled the Janus lawsuit. This is the suit attacking public sector unions. So Neil Gorsuch actually spoke at a Fund for American Studies event held at the Trump Hotel here in D.C. while Janus was pending before the court. That is, I think, rather extraordinary because it indicates just how little Gorsuch cares about the public appearance of possible corruption here. I do not personally think that Gorsuch has been bought off. I don't know that there's a quid pro quo here. In fact, I don't think that there is. But I know that we need to have confidence in an independent judiciary. And when the same people who are bankrolling your fancy lunch at Trump Hotel are also bankrolling the major lawsuit against unions before your court, I think you probably have a conflict of interest.
Well, we're going to talk more about what the Janus case means for unions next Thursday with longtime union organizer Jane McAlevey. I want to ask you a couple questions, Bob, about a New York Times story that's getting a lot of attention today. It's called Inside the White House's Quiet Campaign to Create a Supreme Court Opening. I just want to read a little bit from this story. It is about the connection between Trump and Justice Kennedy. According to this story, one person who knows both men remarked on the affinity between them, which is not obvious at a first glance. And then it goes on to say that Mr. Trump was quick to note in the moments after his first address to Congress in 2017, and as he made his way out to the chamber, Trump paused to chat with the justice and said, quote, "Say hello to your boy, special guy," talking about Kennedy's son, Justin. The younger Mr. Kennedy spent more than a decade at Deutsche Bank, eventually rising to become the bank's global head of real estate capital markets. He worked closely with Donald Trump when he was a real estate developer, according to two people with knowledge of his role. During Justice Kennedy's tenure, Deutsche Bank became Donald Trump's most important lender, dispensing well over $1 billion in loans to him for the renovation and construction of skyscrapers in New York and Chicago at a time when other banks were weary of doing business with him because of his troubled business history. What do you think about this, Bob? How significant is this?
Well, I didn't know about it. It doesn't, you know, create legal conflicts of interest or anything like that. And to say that President Trump has a personal relationship with Justice Kennedy is, I don't think of them as similar personality types, but it's not particularly shocking. But let's look at what happened. I mean, they ask about what's Justice Kennedy's legacy. Well, in the last week of his tenure, he voted to uphold the travel ban. He voted, you know, for Janus, and maybe most significantly, he chose to retire, not only with President Trump still in office, as Trump himself pointed out, but with Republicans still in the majority in the Senate. I understand he may well have figured it's time to leave. I've been on the court more than 30 years. I'm 81 years old, time with my family, and so on and so forth. The timing of his retirement suggests that he's quite content with the president having a fairly free hand to select his successor. Whatever Justice Kennedy's legacy is, that's certainly part of it, that he will be replaced by someone who is no doubt to his right, who is someone that President Trump wants, and he goes out by, you know, basically casting a deciding vote for President Trump's signature policy on immigration and keeping people out of the country. So I don't know about, you know, intimately about the subjects the Times wrote about, but by outward appearances, Justice Kennedy's legacy is going to be in part to increase President Trump's influence on the court, the legal system, and the country.
Well, I hope if he does some book tours or something after he's gone, someone will ask him, why did you step down knowing that abortion could be illegal in many states across the country? Why do you think he would do this, Bob?
Yeah, I don't know. Other than that, I think Justice Kennedy has very mixed feelings about abortion. As I said, in that so-called partial birth abortion case, and I say so-called because it's a term that opponents have used, but in the mid to late term abortion case, he said, you know, based on very little evidence, that many women come to regret their abortions. He voted in this week's case that California was violating the free speech rights of anti-abortion groups by requiring them to post a notice about the availability of abortion. I think he has mixed feelings about it, was willing to preserve either in the name of precedent or simply in the name of not imposing an undue burden on women, to preserve the core of Roe versus Wade. Why would he step down now? He hasn't told me, and I should tell you, he was once my constitutional law professor more than 30 years ago. Mm. But you can draw your own conclusions from the timing. He is quite content to step down at a time when President Trump and a Republican Senate can pick his successor, and draw your conclusions about what that means for the future of the court and what Justice Kennedy is content to do.
We're also talking about voting rights, a number of environmental protections. Mark, why do you think he stepped down right now?
Well, I think that hit the nail on the head. He is a Republican, a lifelong Republican who has an affinity for Trump, we now know, a personal affinity, and he seems to think that his successor under Trump is more likely to uphold the bulk of his legacy than a successor under a Democratic president would. Perhaps we now know which of his rulings he values the most. I think if he valued his decisions regarding abortion and same-sex marriage the most, he would have held out until at least there was a Democratic Senate under a Republican president. But instead, he decided to step down now under a Republican president whom he likes, and a Republican Senate where Democrats have very little power. Mm-hmm. That means that his decisions in cases like Citizens United upholding unlimited corporate electioneering, his vote in the anti-abortion, the federal, quote, partial birth abortion ban regarding late-term abortions, his vote gutting the Voting Rights Act, his vote allowing an individual right to bear arms. These conservative decisions are the ones that will now be upheld and expanded in the post-Kennedy court. And so I guess those are the ones that he valued the most personally.
Moving forward, Mark, what questions do you think reporters should be asking about what is next? Because I've been hearing some softball interviews with people from the Federalist Society, and of course they're going to come on and say, you know, the people that we're looking at are qualified, they will follow the law. I mean, we hear this constantly, but what questions should reporters be asking?
It's very difficult because you have to remember, these people in the Federalist Society and the Judicial Crisis Network, people like Carrie Severino, who was just given an egregious softball interview on NPR that didn't even identify her as the individual who funneled all of that dark money into Gorsuch's campaign, these people have literally worked and waited a lifetime, all of their careers, for this precise moment, for one overarching reason, which is to overturn Roe v. Wade and ban abortion. That is their life's work, and they have it now within their sight. They are not going to ruin that by saying the quiet part out loud. They know they are supposed to lie and obfuscate and obviate the reality here. And so I think it's just important for reporters like us to be dogged and fierce in our questioning, to say, what is it that you want? What are you really aiming for? Follow the money trail. Follow the money that's about to be poured into this Senate confirmation battle. Figure out what the real motivations are, and don't let people like Carrie Severino just lie and lie like the president. Call them out and keep the truth in sharp focus.
And I think it's a question, too.
Just quickly,
Bob.
It
needs to be asked to senators like Senator Collins and Senator Murkowski. Mm. You say you are for abortion rights. What does that mean when push comes to shove? I mean, is it important enough to vote against a Supreme Court nominee from a president of your party? Or will you just say, oh, it's one of several factors, as they have said so far, and kind of, you know, in their interviews so far? You know, those are the elected officials, and I think they need to be held to account in some way.
Bob Agelko is a reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. Mark Joseph Stern is a reporter for Slate. Thank you both for your reporting. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Glad to be there.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.